Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. It is a Monday, and I don't know why, but it does feel like all of a sudden we're getting an awful lot of policy that's happening on a Monday. Perhaps it's just a sign of how turmoil-ridden British politics has been recently, that it seems odd to be actually talking about quite a lot of policy. But anyway, today we have Rishi Sunak is in Bali for the G20 summit. That's his first big foray into foreign diplomacy. So he's been greeted by dancers on the way into the conference centre there in Bali in Indonesia, along with the rest of the world leaders who are filing in. We saw them there a short time ago. He's written in the Telegraph ahead of this meeting with some of his goals for this. We're told that he's pushing for global action to bring down the cost of living, boost global trade, prevent starvation, and to end the war in Ukraine as well. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on as well, but it's not the only policy announcement we've had this morning.
Yeah, also an agreement with France on trying to limit the number of people crossing the English Channel in small boats. That rumbling thing which the government has been trying and really failing to tackle for the whole of this year, really. The deal is to increase patrols along the beaches with 40% more officers. It's to cost the UK some £63 million, although we're already giving money to the French for this at the moment, so this is just an increase on that. And it does mean for the first time that specialist UK officers will be embedded with their French counterparts. Yeah, it does seem like there are lots of announcements. I don't know if this is what it's going to be like with the new PM. There's going to be lots and lots of stuff, or maybe it's a coincidence, or perhaps...
Maybe we've just been distracted by other things for so long that we're just not used to the idea that something's actually kind of normal government is happening, and certainly normal foreign affairs seem to be happening, as these are, you know, both sort of big set-piece agreements in the case of France and an event in case of the G20 as well. So perhaps it's a sign of normal politics, dare we say it, normal politics resuming?
Oh my goodness.
Could this be happening?
Or perhaps, the cynic in me said, maybe it's trying to distract from grim economic news?
Surely
possibly.
Not. Possibly. Surely not. This is, as the Times cartoon has a good cartoon today of the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt in a TV studio surrounded by axes, saws and swords saying, I don't want to be drawn on the specifics of Thursday's budget, but, and this is as we've been hearing and Bloomberg's been reporting, that Jeremy Hunt is expected to delay much of the £55 billion of savings needed to fill the hole in the public finances in the autumn statement on Thursday. So the idea will be is the measures will be announced, but they'll just be pushed back a few years, so perhaps won't bring so much immediate pain to the country or indeed to Tory voters either. We did get a taste of how bad things might be, though, from the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt. He was speaking to some of the Sunday news shows. Let's take a listen.
We're all going to be paying a bit more tax, I'm afraid, but it's not just going to be bad news. I think what people recognise is that if you want to give people confidence about the future, you have to be honest about the present and you have to have a plan.
Well, let's bring in our guest, Sarah Olney, who's Treasury spokesperson for the Liberal Democrats. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg UK Politics. What do you make so far of all this speculation we've heard about the autumn statement?
Well, hi, good morning. Thanks very much for having me on. I think it is pretty bleak, to be honest, and I think that's what most people will be hearing this morning and be expecting to hear on Thursday. But I think for a lot of people, the news that we can expect tax rises will obviously not be welcome at all during the cost of living crisis, which is really starting to bite very hard now. But of course, we've also heard from Rishi Sunak that the main priority is to stability and to retain credibility with the markets. And I think a lot of people would like to be hearing that the main priority is to protect those on the lowest incomes during the cost of living crisis, or perhaps to stimulate growth. But it seems to me that these tax rises that we're all going to have to face, as the Chancellor said at the weekend, is pretty much to pay for the mess that the Conservatives have made of the economy. The reason we don't have stability in the international monetary markets or credibility internationally, it's entirely because of the mess that the Tories have made of things.
Is that correct, though? Or is it because we're spending £10 billion a month on energy subsidies? Surely governments right across Europe are facing a similar fiscal mess.
Well, they are, but I think you can see that the situation in the UK is significantly worse. We've got the worst levels of growth in the G7, for example. And there's no doubt that the markets are much more sensitive to what the UK government are doing than they are to other governments across Europe. But I think also, what we're starting to see is that the liabilities on the energy price guarantees are not as great as we thought they might be. The wholesale cost of gas is coming down. And thanks to, an abnormally warm October and November, which in itself, of course, is a bit of a cause for concern, but we haven't had the demand for gas for domestic heating that we thought we might do. So those indicators are actually perhaps more positive than we might have thought. But there's no doubt that the need to improve stability in the money markets is entirely down to the disastrous mini budget from September that the Conservative government introduced, and that we've got ongoing issues with growth, with productivity, with our workforce that urgently need to be addressed. And that's not going to be helped if we see large cuts to public services.
Well, the government's argument would be is that they don't have the margin to do anything if they can't borrow effectively on the markets, and calming things down after the events of the past couple of months has to come before any other measures. But what would your party do differently then in this situation?
Well, I think we've been calling for over a year for a windfall tax on oil and gas companies. One of the reasons for that, of course, is they're making excess profits at the moment due to the very high cost of wholesale gas. And we would have brought that in a year ago. It would have brought in a lot more tax revenue over the last year. And we've seen, Rishi Sunak did bring in a windfall tax on oil and gas, but the recent accounts that Shell have published, the recent results show they paid nothing in windfall tax. And the reason for that is because the government have allowed them to offset further oil and gas exploration against their windfall tax liabilities. So they're actually incentivizing further fossil fuel extraction instead of getting an effective windfall tax for to help keep British families and pensioners warm this winter. So I think there's a lot more they could be doing to look at tax revenues from oil and gas, and also from banks. We're seeing them getting record profits from higher interest rates. And there are other sources of revenue we could be looking at. But let's not forget, we are in the very tight fiscal hole that we're in because of the government's actions over the last few months.
It does sound like the government is leaning towards asking the better off to pay more. That's something that your party can get on board with, presumably.
Well, obviously, we would have to look at the exact proposal. But, there's no doubt that, things look different depending where you're at. There are certainly people who've benefited a great deal more over the last decade than others. And I think probably it is time to have a look at things like capital gains tax. And see if there's something that can be done about allowances, perhaps, there. We would certainly be supportive
of home
measures
sellers?
In those.
If you were looking at changing
sellers,
things for capital gains tax?
I think we would look at things like the amount of allowance on capital gains tax. I think we would want to see the full proposals that the government are putting forward.
Now, one of the ideas that we're reporting on today is that Jeremy Hunt may push back some of the spending cuts that have to be announced until after the next election. Isn't that going to put the next government, whoever they may be, in a very difficult position financially?
Well, I think that would undermine the government's stated objective of reintroducing stability. What is the point of announcing cuts that have to be implemented by the next government? I think everyone can see the opinion polls that you wouldn't have much confidence that those cuts were eventually going to be implemented if you thought that they could only be done by the next government. So I think that would be a sleight of hand. It would be a very highly political move, but it's not going to do much, I don't think, to restore faith in the economy. But apart from anything else, you know, we're deeply worried about cuts. What we really want to see is, you know, pensions and benefits to rise in line with inflation, when we really do need to see continued funding for our health service. We've got a massive backlog of people waiting for treatment, and that's having a knock-on impact on our workforce levels. And we're deeply, deeply concerned at the stories we're hearing about potential cuts to schools. Now, I've been speaking to schools in my constituency, and they're having to find the money for teacher pay rises of 5% or more out of existing budgets. And their budgets are all, 85% of their budget already goes on wage costs. They simply don't have the money. They're going to have to start cutting staff. So we're deeply concerned about what impact that might have on children and young people, and again, of course, our future growth and prosperity if we're not investing in education and skill.
So you want money for pensions, benefits, the NHS, schools. Presumably you're not going to cut the £10 billion a month energy subsidy. And also, I read, you want a mortgage protection fund. This is a long list of spending commitments, isn't it?
I mean, we're in such a difficult time. I'm not shying away from how difficult it is, but I do think we're in this position because of past decisions by this Conservative government that they're now asking everybody else to pay for. But I've already, you know, outlined what we would do, what we would have done, if you like, around the windfall tax. But you know, they're also proposing to cut the bank levy, for example, from I think 8% to 3%. We wouldn't do that. So, you know, there are other sources of income. But, you know, we are very much in this position because of the chaos that's been wrought by the Conservative government.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Now, central bank policymakers are not known for being outspoken, but what happens when they're allowed to speak their mind? Well, Michael Saunders left the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee this August.
He's now taken up a job as senior advisor to Oxford Economics, and he's been speaking in his first interview in that role to our UK correspondent, Lizzie Burden. She asked him what he makes of the past 6 years of Conservative government.
Well, it's been a chaotic period, hasn't it? We've had 5 prime ministers. 7 chancellors, I think. I apologise if I've missed out one or two of them. And also in economic terms, it's been a challenging period with the Brexit vote, the depreciation of sterling, a long period of political uncertainty, the pandemic, and then renewed political uncertainty. And I think perhaps the main legacy of that period is that the economy's potential output, what it can produce without generating inflation, has been weak. Indeed, the Bank of England's monetary policy report that came out recently implies that the economy's potential output has fallen outright since the end of 2019 and will grow by less than 1% per year in the next few years. And that implies low growth of living standards and constant battle over whether to raise taxes or to cut public spending. And I think getting higher potential growth is really the big economic challenge of the next few years.
Well, you mentioned Brexit. London's lost its crown to Paris as the biggest stock market in Europe. Is the City of London permanently damaged by Brexit?
You know, I would cast the net wider than that. The UK economy as a whole has been permanently damaged by Brexit. It's reduced the economy's potential output significantly, eroded business investment. I mean, look, if we hadn't had Brexit, we probably wouldn't be talking about an austerity budget this week. The need for tax rises, spending cuts, wouldn't be there if Brexit hadn't reduced the economy's potential output so much.
Does the government need to be more open about that?
Well, I think for the country as a whole, this question of how we raise potential output, that really is the thing, I think, which is going to be the big challenge. I mean, look, if I have to say, Liz Truss, in her brief failed premiership, got that one point right. that raising potential output is the big challenge. I think her diagnosis of the problem and her suggested solution to cut taxes and to deregulate are wrong. I would put the emphasis more on improving trade links with the EU, improving education, training, and also fixing this worrying rise in long-term sickness, which has been reducing the workforce so much.
And in the fiscal statement on Thursday, is there a danger that the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, overcompensates in his attempts to plug the fiscal gap?
Well, I think the challenge for Hunt this week is to try to close the fiscal gap without further damaging the economy. It's clear from the business surveys that the economy is in a tough place. Probably got shrinking GDP in Q4 after a drop already in Q3. So you don't want to make that worse. So I have to say, the kind of things that I would look for if I was him would be to do measures which don't damage the economy so much. So perhaps introducing a tiered system of interest rates on banks' reserves, reducing tax relief for top-rate taxpayers on pension contributions, closing some of the loopholes on non-DOMs, reducing the dividend tax allowance. These kind of measures would probably have a less adverse immediate effect on the economy than raising the headline tax rates or cutting the main departmental public spending.
And we've also got inflation in double digits in the UK. Has the bank failed in its duty to fight inflation? You, of course, were the hawk of the committee.
Look, I do think it's useful to look back at policy decisions and forecasts from previously. I have to say, I think it's wrong to over-personalise it and to put it in terms of this person was right and that person was wrong. It's more important to try to learn the lessons from that period. And the big surprise, compared to the Bank of England's forecast from a year ago, is that the economy's supply side, its potential output, has been weaker. Productivity growth has been soft. The workforce has been lower than expected. As I said, much of that is due to long-term sickness. And you've got to try to incorporate the lessons from those economic surprises into your current policy assessment and to your forecast.
So how much further do rates need to rise?
I think they've still got some way to go. I would be cautious about saying exactly how much, but I think they probably have some further to go. And that's really to make sure that we don't end up with a lasting inflation problem. Remember, the inflation we've got is largely the result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has boosted energy prices. But there's also a substantial part of it which is domestic homegrown. And we've got to make sure that that doesn't persist, so that even once the energy effect fades, which it will do eventually, we get inflation back to the 2% target.
That's the former Bank of England policymaker Michael Saunders, now of Oxford Economics, speaking to Bloomberg's Lizzie Burden.
Well, let's talk about matters international now. Rishi Sunak is making his first major foray into diplomacy as Prime Minister with his trip to the G20 in Bali. That is, if you don't count a flying visit to the COP talks. We're told he's going to push for global actions to bring down the cost of living, boost global trade, prevent starvation, and end the war in Ukraine. A pretty long list. Well, joining us now is Bloomberg's senior international affairs reporter, Mark Champion. Mark, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today. Now, this is our sort of first chance to see Rishi Sunak in action on the world stage. What do we know about how he's going to approach this?
Well, it's pretty clear that he will want to kind of draw a line between what I think internationally has been seen as a bit of a disaster in the UK. First you had Boris Johnson, who was very strong on Ukraine, but often was not seen as a serious player in a number of ways on the international scene. And then you had Liz Truss, who really didn't have the chance to make much of an impact abroad, but the impact on her domestic foreign policy and the fact that she lasted such a short time left an impression of really chaos and disorder in the UK. So he'll want to draw a line there, and he's in a reasonably good position to do so. He was Chancellor through the Chancellor of the Exchequer through the COVID period. That will be remembered, and He's also the first British Prime Minister of Indian extraction, and he'll be going to the G20, where that could actually play a role. He will be seeing the Prime Minister of India when he's there.
Okay. Mark, I think our listeners will sympathise with searching for words to try and describe everything that's happened in UK politics over the past couple of months. But we are looking at Rishi Sunak now with a long list of goals, and based on what he wrote in the Telegraph today of what he hopes to achieve at the G20, where might Rishi Sunak and the UK hope to make the most impact?
Well, you know, expectations for this particular meeting are extremely low. So I think this is mainly about, presentation of Sunak and the UK. And that's, if he can do that correctly, he will have achieved something. But in terms of, solving world hunger and these kinds of issues, yes, there is a grain deal that needs to be agreed or renewed to get grain out of Ukraine and keep that on the global markets in order to suppress any renewal of grain price inflation. But that's not necessarily going to be done at the G20. There's going to be a lot of difficulty even getting a joint statement out because the geopolitics are so divisive at the moment. Because of the war in Ukraine, it's going to be very, very hard to achieve the kinds of things that he's talking about.
We know that Xi and Biden will be meeting today. What do we know about UK-China relations? It does seem that the UK has been moving apart from Beijing over the last few years. Is that relationship going to remain quite testy?
Yes, I would imagine so. I mean, we're at the very beginning of Sunak's reign in office, but from everything that he's said so far on the key foreign policy briefs, the Ukraine-Russia war, China, he is basically indicating that he's going to continue, UK foreign policy. He hasn't indicated any kind of radical shift. That is likely to remain tense, as is the relationship between, Xi and Biden, the US and China, just because they're having a meeting, first meeting since before COVID between the leaders of the two countries. That doesn't mean that those tensions are going to disappear. They're really just trying to find ways of preventing them from escalating.
Of course, this is a chance too for Rishi Sunak to have time with European leaders away from the usual business that they're going to be that they talk about, and particularly away from post-Brexit relations. Is this a chance for Rishi Sunak to make some friends on the continent?
Yes, that's the kind of thing that can be done at the G20. I imagine that he will. It remains the most important relationship for the UK to fix after Brexit, after Johnson, who was not popular abroad, as I mentioned earlier with Liz Truss. I think there will be some hope on the continent that there will be a steadier pair of hands to work through all the many issues that still have to be dealt with between the UK and the EU, who, geography simply throws together.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.